Committee will come to order. I believe there's a quorum. Representative Hamilton, would you like to approve the minutes from the last meeting?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Yes. The minutes are approved. Thank you for coming, Ms. Tom. You being here gives us a presentation on good population decline in Minnesota and what means that to rural Minnesota. As rural members, this is an important issue for our district, especially as we approach a new census. So I'm looking forward to the time that you're here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Minnesota Department of Administration. I was asked to talk a bit about population decline in rural Minnesota, and rural population change and population decline is a subject that I've been studying off and on for about 40 years now, so it's one that I find very interesting and intriguing. It's one for which there is quite a bit of history as well as some surprises. In Minnesota, since the 2000 census, 46 of our 87 counties have declined in population. This is not unusual in the heartland of the United States. Many of the counties in the American heartland, the middle of the country, have lost population, and some counties have lost population for decades, going back to the late 1800s or early 1900s. Southwestern and western Minnesota in particular, and counties and portions of northern Minnesota are particularly characteristic of this trend. The trend of population decline in rural areas really parallels the dramatic increases in productivity, particularly farm productivity, that occurred in the late 1800s, early 1900s, throughout most of the 1900s and continues to today. Reducing the size of the population necessary to produce food for everybody else, and as a result, that led to people seeking their opportunities in other areas, moving to the large cities for young people moving to large cities to seek their fortunes. Over time, the out-migration of young people has resulted in rapid aging of population in many of our rural areas, and that has led directly to declining birth rates as well as rising death rates, which then goes further to complete this cycle of population decline. We do also see periodic and occasional cases of sudden growth in areas that have been declining over a period of time, and I'll try to explain a couple of examples of this, as well as the general tendency of population decline to parallel economic cycles that either increase the process or retard the process. If we look at a map of the United States, many of the counties in the Midwest, the Great Plains area of the United States, have been declining for some time, all the way from the Mexican border to the Canadian border, and even beyond into Canada. The Great Plains area of Canada also parallels the same kind of change, and some of the counties in Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, and Missouri, and some of those counties have been declining really since the late 1800s. In Minnesota, we have counties that began to decline in 1920, and many of those continue to experience declines in population. The purple portions in this map are the portions that have lost population since the beginning of this decade, and what we see is population loss areas in southwestern in western Minnesota and across the northern tier of the state. And if you just looked at Minnesota, you would think, my gosh, what is happening here? But if we look to expand this outward into surrounding areas, we find that most of the Dakotas, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, much of Oklahoma and Texas, eastern Colorado, much of Montana, much of the whole heartland of the United States is experiencing population decline at this time. As I mentioned, Saskatchewan in Canada has lost about 1% of its population in this decade. Manitoba, to our direct north, has been growing, but only at about half the rate of Minnesota. Minnesota and South Dakota are really the growth stars of the entire Midwest and Northeast portions of the United States right now. It always pains me to say this, but right now South Dakota is growing slightly faster than Minnesota in population. Over the long run, we have, of the last half century or so, we've grown a bit faster. North Dakota is joins Louisiana as the only states to have declined in population so far this decade, although it appears Michigan may join them in the next year. If we look at Minnesota specifically, what we see is the population declines are particularly strong and along the western border of the state and portions of the northern tier of counties. That southwest and western and northern tier are characteristics of counties that some of the counties have been declining for some time going back to the early part of last century into the early 1900s, and we have this area in addition to the areas that have been declining. We have an area of extremely rapid growth from roughly the Brainerd area through the Brainerd-Baxter area through St. Cloud. Including the suburban and exurban counties around the Twin Cities and down to Rochester that continues to experience extremely rapid growth. Some of the more rapidly growing counties of the nation are in that area, but we continue to see counties in western Minnesota that have experienced very long-run population loss. The trend really had its beginning in the declines, particularly in Minnesota, in the declines in the farm population, which peaked around 1920 in the 1920s and has been declining ever since and is substantially smaller now than it was in the Civil War era. The farm population of the United States has dropped dramatically, and that drop parallels the fantastic increase in productivity. If you just take one indicator, which is the number of hours of labor for a U.S. farmer to produce 100 bushels of corn, in 1850 it took between 75 and 90 hours to produce 100 bushels of corn. By 1987, that was down to 2.75 hours, and since then it's been difficult to measure. You know, it's getting so small that the productivity has been fantastic, and as a result, we need far less labor now on farms in rural America than we did 100 years ago to produce the foods and goods and services that we're producing as a result. Many young people have moved to the cities, to the larger metropolitan areas, and much of the growth of the Twin City metropolitan area, for example, has resulted from that dramatic increase in the number of young people available to move out of rural areas into the larger metropolitan areas. And we continue to see growth in the metropolitan areas of Minnesota while the non-metropolitan areas see very small to very modest growth in the state. If we take a few examples, and I know this at first sight looks like spaghetti soup, but what I've selected here are seven counties that illustrate many of the trends that I think we see over time in Minnesota. If you look back to 1900, to the left portion of the graph, what you see is that all of these counties, all seven counties, were roughly in the 10,000 to 20,000 size range. They had roughly the similar scale of population. And then as the counties changed over time, first I direct your attention to Steele counties and to Steele County and McLeod County. Are the two counties that rise fairly sharply result in the highest population going forward in the future. These counties shared a couple of characteristics. One is growth in manufacturing and in various aspects of manufacturing over time. But they also, to some degree, and I think this is particularly important since 1970, are on the outer ring, sort of the outer shed of the Twin City metropolitan area, and to some degree share in that growth. Steele County, in particular, I remember people in the 80s talking about. In Owatonna, talking about living in the 100-mile ring, and there was a lot of talk about the 100-mile ring around the Twin Cities, and you had daily commuters commuting into the Twin Cities. That has also been true of McLeod, though to a lesser degree, but McLeod now is right on the edge of extremely rapid growth. Todd County, which is the light blue line with or medium blue line with a light blue shaded box in the middle of the graph. Todd County, by contrast, has changed very little since 1900. There have been periods of population decline and periods of population increase. We noted population increase during the 1970s, but then came the 80s, and then there was population decline. But then, in the 1990s, population increase began to accelerate in Todd County, but not a dramatic increase. We included Todd County in a series of studies we did in the early 1990s called the Turnaround Counties Study, where we looked at selected counties that had turned around their population change from loss to gain and asked the question why specifically these happened. And while the explanations were all quite varied, there were some general themes. In Todd County, we began to see growth, particularly of some of the lakes areas, around some of the lakes areas, around Osakis and some of the other areas of Todd County. Pine County experienced fairly strong growth up to about 1920, when it leveled off, and that was during the peak of the lumbering era in Pine County. By 1940, the population began to decline, reaching a low point around 1970, and then began to increase, but the increase really accelerated after the 1980s, when particularly with the growth in the Hinckley area and casinos and other resort related activity in Pine County. And the projection is for continued strong growth in Pine County going forward. Cottonwood County, by contrast, and really for Cottonwood and Pennington both, have experienced relatively little change over a long period of time. Pennington is on a slight upturn right now, and Cottonwood County is on a slight drift downward. Again, they generally tend to show this more prosperous period in the 70s and the 90s, and a more negative period in the 1980s. And then Norman County, it basically has been on a downward drift since about 1920, and continues to decline in population, characteristic of much of what is happening in the entire upper Midwest area of the nation. Business cycles then have had an impact in the rural economy, coupled with a term that economists use, the terms of trade. The terms of trade generally were negative for the rural economy throughout the 20s and 30s and even into the 60s, and turned much more positive during the 1970s. The 20s through the 60s were a period of much larger population loss and a much more substantial out-migration of population of many of other rural communities of the United States. The 70s saw a resurgence in economic growth, a rise in particularly in farm prices and in land prices, and a resurgence in economic growth in much of rural America. And in fact, this is really sort of embarrassing, but the term at the time towards the end of the 70s was the rural renaissance. And I one of the dangers of talking about this is that Calvin Beal and I did a presentation, and I believe it was 1980 at the Countryside Council in Marshall, talking about the rural renaissance, how things had really changed around, and how everything was up, and about a week later the whole economy dropped. And then the 1980s came. That was a very negative time, particularly in the early 1980s. Huge credit problems, farm foreclosures, many towns experienced declines in their retail sales. Hardware stores were closing up, grocery stores, filling stations, things like that. Just driving through much of rural Minnesota, there were many places that uncharacteristically needed a new coat of paint. And in the early 1980s, everything just had sort of a very, very dismal look to it. But then the 1990s, and really starting in the late 80s, but into the 1990s, saw a resurgence in rural America, and we saw this certainly in Minnesota. It happened in some other states where increasing numbers of counties were turning around in population, and we can point to a lot of individual reasons for why this happened. In Swift County, it was you invest in the one industry that you're not, you know, isn't going to go down. That's the prison industry. So you build a private prison, and someplace else you encourage manufacturing. In another county, you encourage resort and tourism trade, and sort of add all that together, and we began to see turnarounds in a number of counties. I tried to search for some kind of unifying theme, and saying, you know, and this is a totally a personal opinion, but part of that is I think the 80s were so negative that many small communities, small towns, counties, clusters of cities refused to let their town die, and formed committees and worked very hard to encourage alternative forms of growth, But there's only so much. There's only so long that you can engage in that kind of extraordinary level of activity. And with the growth, many of these committees disbanded, and in many areas, there's not a lot of activity right now. And so that growth has since then moderated. So another way, and here I picked three counties to look at, another way of looking at this, and this combines estimates of something called net migration from a group of famous demographers, Gladys Bowles and Cal Beal being among those, and then more recently estimates by the U.S. Census Bureau since 1980. But looking at net migration, which is the difference, the sort of the residual between the number of people moving in minus the number of people moving out, and we see was very strong out migration in many rural counties in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. If we had estimates for the 20s and 30s, that would have shown equally large levels of out migration, where substantially more people moved out of the counties than moved in. By the time we got into the 70s, this for many counties turned around. For Todd County, we can see that resulted actually in a period of a net inflow of people into Todd County. For Cottonwood County, it did not result in a net inflow of people. However, it did substantially reduce that net outflow. And the 70s were generally viewed as a much more positive time. And in the 80s came, and migration really turned negative in many counties, and Cottonwood and Todd County certainly show this tendency that recovered to a substantial degree during the 1990s. But one of the other aspects of this that I would direct your attention to is that the amount of change from one period to the next seems to be dampening, and that would actually be consistent with what we believe will go forward in terms of projections. And it's consistent with the fact that as these counties age in population, which I'll talk about in just a second, as they age in their population and grow older people are less likely to move. And most of the people who move are people in their 20s and 30s, and if there's much fewer people in their 20s and 30s and a lot more people in their 60s and 70s, that simply has the impact of reducing the overall amount of moving around in population. Looking in terms of the trends and cycles of population change, and I've already mentioned this a couple times, but it certainly bears looking at more detail, is that long-term out-migration of youth has led to an older population in rural counties. This results in slower growth with people moving out. That draws down growth, but also a declining natural increase. With the young people moving out also is their future reproductive capacity. And you know, just as the population ages, death increase and births tend to increase. One result of this is a dramatic slowing in the rate of growth in the labor force, which can have a real limiting effect on future population change. If we look at where the populations are oldest in Minnesota, what we find again is that many of the oldest counties are rural counties, particularly in southwestern and western Minnesota, particularly areas around Traverse and Big Stone and that area. Aitken County is also a very old population, but that's a little bit different circumstance. That Aitken County is aging in large part because people are moving there for retirement, building lake cottages. which further illustrates that even though we can talk in generalities about rural population decline, there are many, many exceptions to any kind of general discussion. If we look at the levels of percent of the population over 65, and this is as of 2007, the highest proportion in Minnesota is in Traverse County on the western border at 28% of the population is over 65. McIntosh, North Dakota is about four counties due west of Traverse on the southern border of North Dakota. That is the highest level in North Dakota at 36.5% of the population is over 65 today. Overall in the state, only in Minnesota about 12.5% of the population is over age 65. The lowest county is Scott County, one of the suburban counties around the Twin Cities, with 6.4% of the population over 65. So we see this huge disconnect between the metropolitan counties, and particularly the suburban counties, and many of the rural counties, with the rural counties being substantially, dramatically older in population, with many of the suburban counties being much, much younger in population. Related to age is natural increase or natural decrease. And natural increase is the difference between birth and death. Natural increase becomes natural decrease when there are more deaths than birth. And we are noticing that as an increasing situation in circumstance of counties in the United States, that over time each year there are more and more counties that are added to this natural decrease group. In Minnesota so far this decade, there are 26 of the 87 counties are experiencing natural decrease in the average year that more people die than are born. 34 counties in North Dakota, 27 in South Dakota, and 43 in Iowa. More than 40% of the counties in that four state area are experiencing natural decrease right now, and that number continues to increase over time as overall age and particularly age in rural counties continues to increase. In terms of population decline, well, it's just very difficult to overcome natural decrease in terms of population change. There are only two sources of growth to population change. One is migration, and the other is natural increase, the difference between birth and death. And if that natural increase is negative, if there are more deaths than births, then that to overcome that requires a substantial in-migration of people into the county. It's not impossible, but it certainly makes the bar higher. One of the aspects of the aging population of the United States and of Minnesota that seems a bit counterintuitive is that actually many of the very oldest counties in southwestern western Minnesota and much of the rest of the country are projected to see declines in their 65 and older population in the future, while the greatest growth in the 65 and older population will occur largely in the suburban ring around the larger cities, and we see this around the Twin Cities, which right now are very young, but over the next decade or two will age very, very rapidly. So if Scott County wants to see what their future is like, maybe they should go to Traverse County and see what is happening in Traverse County. The declines in population are largely of 65 and older in rural areas is largely due to the fact simply that population groups have declined to the point over a long period of time that the age structure is sort of an inverted age structure with more people at extreme ages than at younger ages. This certainly has an impact on labor force, and we are also projecting a dramatic decrease in the rate of growth of the labor force over the next decade. By 2020 in Minnesota and the United States, labor force growth will be nearly zero. The change that we expect to see in various areas of Minnesota certainly mirrors that. We have regions that will be experiencing declines in their workforce, particularly in the northwest and northeast portions, and along the western border and in southwestern Minnesota are the areas where we will see the lowest rates of workforce growth. The most rapid rates of workforce growth will occur in the central and east central portion of the state, from St. Cloud east of there, north of the Twin Cities. Certainly, slow growth in the labor force is going to affect communities in many ways. One of the things that we are already seeing is critical shortages of certain types of occupations. Many areas of Minnesota are already designated as deficient areas for dentistry and for physicians and surgical care. Nursing is oftentimes in very short supply in rural areas. It's not just western Minnesota and southwestern Minnesota, but throughout that whole area of population decline, what has happened is that the healthcare providers have, like everybody else, aged and either moved away or died, and leaving substantial shortages of healthcare professionals. Other occupations are also similarly in short supply, or will be occupations such as engineering and similar kinds of technical positions that are really critical to the operation of the county or cities or school districts within the area. Absence of available labor supply in some areas may limit the potential for economic growth, unless an employer who wishes to expand, unless that employer can find a workforce from some other location, they may be limited from locating in that area. Those who can will attract people from other parts of the country and other parts of the world to fill the demand for labor, resulting in other changes in the community. One change that we see in the community is dramatic change in the racial and ethnic characteristics of communities, and we see this overall in Minnesota, but in counties such as Todd County, over the last 17 years, from virtually no one of minority race or ethnicity to now over 5%. Perhaps the most dramatic was in Nobles County, from a fairly non-diverse population to one of the more diverse populations in the state. This shows up also in language spoken at home for students enrolled in school, and here I've done a ranking of school districts with more than 500 enrollments. The most language diverse school district in Minnesota is St. Paul, with 44% of its student body speaking a language other than English at home, but the second most is Worthington. That is also directly related to an employer and the growth of that employer in the early 1990s resulted in a dramatic increase in demand for labor, which turned a community and a county that had been declining in population over a long period of time into a county that began to grow, but also grow in many other ways. In addition to some of the suburban counties, such as Columbia, or school districts such as Columbia Heights, Brooklyn Center, and Richfield, other school districts that have seen dramatic change include St. James, Sleepy Eye, and Westbrook. Until last year, Sleepy Eye was tied with Minneapolis. Minneapolis has now fallen off of this list. Minneapolis is now 10th, with less than 30% of the student body speaking a language other than English at home, and Westbrook has taken its place. So dramatic changes are occurring and can certainly occur and are oftentimes related to an employer, an infusion of new young people, younger population into the community, but the younger population represents a very new population in many ways. So, in conclusion, more than half of Minnesota counties are declining in population. That's been true for some time. The rates of decline are actually a little bit more moderate in the 90s in this decade than they have been in some of the past decades. The declines generally result from out-migration of young adults leaving behind a much older population, and that increases the age of the population, in which reduces natural increase and further reinforces that population decline aspect. With aging of the workforce and decline in the workforce, then also limiting economic growth potential. And with that, any questions, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Representative Irvin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Gillespie.
Thank you.
I think a natural question that comes up is how can we keep young people in rural Minnesota? And obviously jobs are an important key to that. And the question then becomes, can we bring jobs to them, or do we bring them to the jobs? And what I'm getting at is here, in terms of transportation, a transit way, busing, railroad, or whatever, for Western Minnesota, there largely is no plan. And we hear that, why should there be a transportation plan or transit plan for that part of the state when you don't have enough people? Well, that then gets into what comes first, the chicken or the egg type of thing. Mm-hmm. If there was an adequate transit way, would we have more people living there to bring them jobs in other places, or would it result in more industry being created in that area? What's your opinion of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, I think the chicken and egg is a good metaphor to use in this case. There are circumstances where a venture capitalist has moved into an area. I think Pipestone is one example right now that has seen the growth of windmill blade production and. Fairly strong growth, where that has resulted in a dramatic increase in the demand for labor that is resulting in a lot of carpooling, busing, things like that from a multiple county area, bringing in people from actually multiple states to work in Pipestone. Housing is a limiting factor right now, as I understand it, in Pipestone. And so that there are limiting factors that with forethought, I think we can overcome those. I think there's remarkable potential for growth and change in much of rural Minnesota, The labor force issue represents a very long run kind of issue for young people with fairly unusual occupation codes or occupation classes that are in much more demand in urban areas. There just simply aren't very many opportunities, and with increasing numbers of families these days requiring essentially two jobs rather than one job for the family, that becomes a much more difficult thing to fill in a rural community, unless we can find some way of directly approaching that subject. Many of the jobs that we've seen grow in more recently in rural Minnesota have been at mid to lower skill level kinds of jobs, and particularly in the meat packing plants and other processing plants. But jobs in the windmill, those can be fair in the windmill blade manufacture can also be fairly skilled jobs. So I think there is a potential. There is a distance issue that I think the community has to overcome.
Madam Chair, a quick follow-up. So, are we correct, or am I correct in my assumption that, I mean, it all revolves around jobs and transportation?
Madam Chair, Representative Erd, the availability of jobs, if there are no jobs, people aren't going to stay. That's an issue. That was part of the reason for the out migration. You know, as we became a much more productive society, there simply weren't the jobs, there weren't the alternatives, and so young people moved to the cities. Cities still provide some attraction. One of the difficult things to understand over the last half century plus, really since World War II, is that survey after survey, when people are asked where would you most like to live, majority of people say they most like to live in a rural area. And yet, many of the rural areas are declining in population, and so you know that begs the question: well, what do you mean by rural? And as it turns out, rural for many people meant well on the outskirts of a big city, places like Steele County and McLeod County, and I say it in Chisago and Mille Lacs and counties such as that, which are on the outskirts of a large and growing city, metropolitan area, but close enough to take advantage of shopping and jobs and entertainment possibilities. What that does for counties that are more remotely located is that doesn't seem to, you know, that people generally are not talking about rural, moving to rural areas that are very remotely located. There's always a few odd and a few exceptional individuals, but as an overall tendency, and that would require some kind of additional effort at economic development. Again, for example, the prison in Swift County in Appleton brought people, but had a double effect. One, past the construction, the staff, the prison facility, to a large extent moved into the area. That had an impact on increasing population. But also, when the prisoners came, that also showed up as an increase in population. And so Appleton's population increase served from a double effect. But once the prison was built and fully staffed and fully occupied, the population change has leveled off since then. And Swift now has gone back to essentially the level of change that they had before.
Representative
Erdahl? Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to belabor this too long, but the counties you cited as benefiting McLeods and those are close enough so people can drive in. The point that I'm trying to make is that if we had an improved transit way, it could be buses or trains or whatever, I don't know what it is, that would create a ring beyond those that that benefit from being able to drive in. And, you know, I think creating more population farther out.
Senator Representative Erdahl, I think you're correct. It's the kind of thing that we wouldn't know until we really tried, specific case studies. But reducing the cost of transportation, both in terms of the lost time as well as the dollar impact of transportation and making transportation less difficult, would tend to expand that that horizon outward out of the to greater and greater distant areas.
Representative Faulk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The most interesting chart that I saw was the one that shows the hours of labor for a U.S. farmer to produce 100 bushels of corn. And I think that this brings up what is, in my opinion, the root cause of this decline in population in outstate Minnesota, is that the average size farm has just increased significantly. And so, you don't have less farmers per section of land out there, which means you have less kids in the school, you have less farms, farmers going to town to grind feed, you have less farm wives going to the grocery store to buy groceries, and it's just dried up those small towns. Would it be possible or advantageous, and they may not be the same thing, to come up with either a tax policy or a farm policy that encouraged the small family farm, so that we try to reverse the trend, maybe not on the hours of labor, but at least reverse the trend on the average size farm, so that if we could, instead of, a farmer farming 40 or 80 quarters, get it back down. When my father was a kid, the average size farm was a quarter section of land. Today, it's probably, in that same area, probably 60 or 80 quarters of land. And, that trend is what I think has caused this. And is there any way we could reverse that trend?
Madam Chair, Representative Faust, that's beginning to get outside of my area of expertise, and my agricultural economics are way too rusty to venture a guess as to how we could through tax policy or some other means encourage smaller farms. There are alternative types of farming that is being pursued now that generally is on a smaller scale, organic farming and other kinds of customized farming and particularly truck farming and things like that generally tend to operate on a much smaller scale, and that may be part of the answer to your question, but I certainly would not suggest that the only effect here was the decline in the farm population. That was not the only cause of the decline, but that's certainly a major contributing factor. And the increase in productivity has just been phenomenal. Unfortunately, a lot of the value of that productivity increase did not come back to the people producing the great productivity increases, but we're spread more throughout our society.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Glassby, I grew up in one of those areas over in western Minnesota. It was really black on the chart there for decline. I think there are three occupied farms on my old school bus route, and that's hardly enough to keep things going out there. My question then for that is, are we past a tipping point in some of these counties? Are they never again going to be anything but summer residents tending their crops and heading south for the winter? Is it too late for those communities? Now, granted, the number of bushels coming out of those counties is phenomenal. The number of whatever it is they're producing is phenomenal. There are a large number of millionaires per acre out there, and a large number of bushels of wheat per acre coming out of there, but there's not very many people. Have they passed the tipping point? Will they ever, no matter what we do for rural development, can we get people back out there without building what Representative Erdahl was referring to for transportation or something else?
Madam Chair, Representative Nody. I'm not sure if I would go as far as to say tipping point, but certainly once you reach that natural decrease where there are more people that die in an average year than are born, that changes the nature of the area. Imagine you're literally going to more funerals than you are Christmas. And that changes not just the numbers, but also begins to change some of the emotional characteristics of the area, and begin to get some rather remarkable kinds of effects in some areas. For example, in the Dakotas in particular, some of the religious organizations have noted that there has been a considerable amount of consolidation of churches, where in a community where there used to be three churches, then there became two and then one. And that creates all sorts of interesting theological implications and things like that. But that is generally a sort of, in some respects, a downward movement that can be reversed, and there have been examples of that reversing. It was one of the reasons why we were so fascinated in the 90s with the turnaround counties that had been declining, some for a long period of time, suddenly started showing some levels of growth, and asking the question of why that was occurring. And in some cases, it was a particular employer and a particular manufacturing entity had a dramatic impact. But beyond that, unless there is something that totally reverses that trend and brings in young people, that natural decrease will tend to force that population to ever smaller and smaller numbers. In the 80s we heard, and into the early 90s we heard a lot about people talking about the Buffalo Commons and things like that. But one of the things that we have seen is an increase, particularly along the northern tier of counties, an increase in the number of counties in the United States that are officially classified as frontier counties. Frontier county is a county with less than six people per square mile. That the population decline just simply gets down to the point that there are so few people, as you mentioned. I remember as a child what a traumatic thing that was when I heard the frontier was closed, because there was no more frontier. Well, we've got the frontiers reopening again, and it's because of this population decline, but it certainly has a very different characteristic than I had imagined when I was a child. That is difficult to reverse. And for some areas into the, if we look into the Dakotas and into Montana, we can find some areas that are much further along in this process than we are at this time. But they have not been able to by and large reverse the trend.
Thank you. And one more question, Madam Chair. This maybe isn't your particular department's job to answer this question, so if it's not, tell me, of those people who use your information, how they're looking at this. Is it a good thing or a bad thing, one or the other, for Minnesota as a whole, if we end up with a few farmers and a few lake retirees and nobody else in rural Minnesota? If this trend continues and we don't get good rural development if we end up with a few very large farms and a few people living around lakes after they retire and nobody else out there, all the young people leaving. But we have lots of good economic growth in the Twin Cities Ring. Good, bad, or indifferent for the whole state?
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, asking for a value judgment on goodness or badness of...
Let's just use economics, then. Let's not ask...
But to sort of nibble around the edge of that question, there are I have some areas of concern. One is the provision of service that farmer, even if there may not be very many of them, they will need health care services. They will need places to buy equipment and to buy food and hardware and other things. That driving ever greater distances takes away that time. If it takes 2.5 hours to drive to the nearest hardware store for a farmer that's producing 100 bushels per 2.5 hours. Of corn, that's 100 bushels of corn. What's the value of that? That can be a fairly expensive issue of having to drive that extra distance, and not to mention the fuel cost and other costs. That lost time can be a very valuable piece of very valuable kind of thing. There may be ways of getting around some of those issues with increasing connectivity through the internet and that kind of potential. But I'm concerned with particularly those healthcare services. There are smaller communities with nursing homes and other healthcare facilities that are now having trouble staffing those facilities, just simply because there aren't many people around. I've talked to county administrators that have noted that their counties have difficulties with providing services like Meals on Wheels and things like that, simply because there's nobody young enough to still be able to do that. And one of the things that strikes me is the disconnect between the experience of the average person in the metropolitan areas and the experience of the average person out there in the smaller communities that has been declining for some time. The disconnect can be rather dramatic, and you know, as being part of one Minnesota, it seems that we should, and this is, of course, an opinion and a value judgment, but it seems like we ought to be able to understand each other. And I think that's getting more and more difficult because of the differences in life experiences.
Thank you.
Representative Gillespie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillespie, my question offers a connection or maybe a segue from your last comment. The slide I'm looking at is the one just prior to your conclusionary slide. And the part of that slide that really grabbed my attention was the really the tripling of the population that is non-English speaking at home in 15 years. Can you characterize for us, if you may, what are the things that are contributing to that? Is it influenced by some of the out-migration, or is it strictly in-migration that's contributing to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Sineski, there's a couple things going on here. One is that there are more people immigrating to the United States and to Minnesota. In this, Minnesota is a much smaller proportion than nationally. Roughly one out of every five children nationally. It's a little bit more than one out of every 10 in Minnesota. So Minnesota is a little bit less diverse, or substantially less diverse than the nation, but clearly we are changing, and changing dramatically. Part of this has to do with immigration from other parts of the world, much of which is related to the workforce. People who tend to move long distances and cross significant boundaries tend to be younger people, people in their 20s and 30s. And they tend to bring their children. And as a result, we see an increase in the number of children who come from different cultures and are speaking different languages. At the same time, the number of the background population in Minnesota is aging. The white, not Hispanic population is aging very rapidly in Minnesota, and their children have largely either grown up and moved away or are in older grades in school. And as a result, what we see in many areas is that the youngest grades tend to be much, much more diverse in racial and ethnic characteristics and in other characteristics such as religion and language and national background and things like that, tend to be much, much more diverse than the older population of the area. So that it's possible to have, for example, a school population that is dramatically a very diverse language and racially and ethnically diverse population with a voting population that is largely not diverse.
Representative Manski.
Well, thanks for your explanation today, Mr. Gillespie. My question would probably go to state financing and policies as it relates to disparities between rural and urban areas. In the areas of social services or medical care or education, you kind of touched on that in your last answer. Are we sometimes maybe putting our rural areas at a disadvantage by, you know, in essence, favoring the funding into the metro area and consequently having less attractive services in rural Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative, in talking with a variety of school district and county and other officials throughout Minnesota, and you just give a few reflections on that. If we look, for example, and this was a much more dramatic thing this middle of the last summer, but I think it will become dramatic again in the future, is the transportation of students. Just simply the movement of students from their home to the school, busing, that in some areas there are so few students per square mile that the distance that children travel is increasing very rapidly. The length of time they spend on the bus is increasing, and the mileage that the bus driver must book and the amount of fuel used can increase very very dramatically. And we've seen that increase, you know, particularly in some of the more widely dispersed rural school districts, with particularly in northwestern Minnesota, is where some of the lowest density rates occur in the student body. The difficulty of finding health care services, sometimes the nearest health care service is in another county. Transportation of patients over that distance can be an issue, not just for their own safety, but also for simply the cost of that transportation. So the distances become, and ever greater distances become in part an issue, in addition to the level of ability or the number of people with the required skills and abilities. Another issue that arises with respect to this particular graph, and here, this was after extensive discussions with various school district officials, particularly in the latter part of the 90s and the early part of this decade, that many school district officials noted, particularly I'm thinking in particular about St. James, noted that the difficulty of finding a teacher that is qualified to teach children who speak other languages other than English. And the difficulty of attracting that teacher to a and basically go on a national search, attracting that teacher to a smaller rural community where the salaries are maybe a little bit lower and the support services are not there, only to have them subsequently bid away by a larger school district, who are also desperately seeking people with these unusual skills. There are some aspects of this that can be particularly difficult, I think, for some of the rural areas of our state.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gillespie, for being here today. And I know, I think maybe even Representative Eakin has worked on some of the issues we were just talking about in terms of sparsity and declining enrollment in our schools. And I know but what I'm hearing from you, Mr. Gillespie, is that at least from an education policy and funding perspective, might be essential that we continue to look at sparsity, sparsely populated school districts, and provide them aid to cover the very transportation costs you're mentioning, the fixed costs the school has. You have a teacher, if you have 12 kids, you have 14 kids, you need a teacher. You need a building. You need to pay the heat. You need to pay the insurance and the like. So, and I'm also glad to hear, Mr. Gillespie, you mentioned St. James, Worthington, Sleepy Eye, districts that, or areas that you mentioned earlier, and they've had tremendous changes, which certainly have both increased their per pupil, so Representative Eakin, they get more money per student, but they also have challenges that come with that as well.
Madam Chair, I don't know if that was a
question. I don't think there was a question. I was thinking,
but thank you.
Noting how important sparsity aid is.
Representative Kia.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to highlight the comments you made that you're trying to get that skill set of those educators there to match what the needs of that area are. But not only do you have to match their skill set, a lot of times you have to match a spouse's skill set, too. In other words, you're trying to attract not only that teacher, but also their spouse and make sure there's a job there. Question I have for you, though, is that when you're looking at the counties that are overcoming this problem, that is seeing a decline, are you seeing it more because they have access to metropolitan areas and the jobs, or are you seeing it because they're creating a niche market within their community, tourism, a prison, new industry growth within that area?
Madam Chair, there's both. One of the things that we noticed, for example, in Todd County was the growth around the lakes, and when we started asking people about their patterns, much of that growth around the lakes was also commuting patterns to St. Cloud, and to which is, when you think about it, really isn't all that far by Twin City standards in terms of time, and you get to live on this beautiful spot. Pretty remarkable. But there's that kind of effect. There are some areas that are heavily tourism-based. Much of Pine County's growth, for example, the resurgent growth, has been related to the casinos and other tourism options, and directly correlates to that. But in other areas, manufacturing is extremely important. All the way from meat packing and food processing. In Sleepy Eye, for example, it's food processing. To in some cases fairly high tech levels of manufacturing. McLeod County, of course, Hutchinson Technologies, the premier producer of shock absorbers for hard drives in the world. That's a difficult business right now to be in. The demand for laptops has been flat to declining, but they're a very progressive company that will find other markets as well to expand into. That the aspect of venture capital becomes a question, and how do you infuse the capital into some of the investment ideas? And I'm not sure that anybody has a real great answer for that one right now. In some cases, there have been outside international investors that have invested in opportunities in Minnesota. It seems like there's a, you know, it would appear to me that there are remarkable opportunities here if we could just simply marshal the resources to, you know, investment resources to make those come to fruition.
Madam Chair, I would just say that this is the initiative then that is really posed to us, is to look at, is it an investment in infrastructure to connect people to jobs, or is it creating new sectors of jobs, and looking at where we can create hubs of new niche markets where we would draw some of those people to that area. So I think that's a debate that we have to wrestle with.
Thank you. Representative Beacon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to ask if there's been any study done on the correlation between state funding and the effects that may have on population. I'm thinking in terms of the fact that we don't have the economies of scale in the rural areas that they do in the metropolitan area, and that does require, I guess, more funding on a per capita basis for things like transportation, healthcare, and things of that nature. And the fact that in the rural areas we do find that in our small towns, the biggest employers are the schools and the nursing homes, which are, you know, funded significantly from state funds. Has there been any study to find any kind of correlation between state funding for our rural economies and state funding for our rural infrastructure, and the effect that that has on the population, the health migration in our rural communities?
Madam Chair, Representative Eakin, I'm searching my mind here. I can't think of anything. There may very well be studies, but I'm not aware of anything off the top of my head. There have been studies looking at the level of transfer payments, transfer payments would include things like Social Security and Medicare and other kinds of other similar kinds of transfers from government to individuals or to organizations. But I think what I'm sensing is that's a little different than what you're thinking about. Social Security is, of course, a major source of income. And as with an aging population, with a much older population, Social Security would be a much larger source of income. But I think you're speaking to something a little bit different in terms of more directed kinds of investment. I'm not aware of anything that's been done that addresses that particular issue.
Representative Krasowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gillespie, page 2 you've got would be your fifth slide. Analyze the percent population change by county. And looking at southwestern Minnesota, we know that that's all red or whatever color that ended up to be. It's very dark on our black and white copies. But do you have an accounting of where those people are going? We know certainly right across the border from them is South Dakota, that has a much more favorable tax policy than Minnesota has. And as a follow-up to that question, would it come to be or make sense that a tax policy has an impact on where people move eventually?
Madam Chair, Representative, and this is not one of the declining counties, but one of the counties I just looked at just last Friday and was visiting out there is Clay County, across, you know, more the Moorhead and Fargo area, across, you know, more the Moorhead and Fargo area. There's actually a movement of people from Fargo into Moorhead. A net in migration. There is a net inflow into the Fargo-Moorhead area, but there is a net migration into Moorhead. Most of the migration that we've looked at over a long period of time, there are various theories of migration, but one of those has to do with the, what's called the gravity theory. Very large and rapidly growing areas tend to draw people in, and much of the migration throughout the whole upper Midwest has been focused on the Twin Cities and surrounding areas. And that is certainly true also in southwestern Minnesota. We can look at individual county relationships using IRS data to look at the flow from one county to the next, both in terms of returns and exemptions, and we do look at that over time. Our relationship with South Dakota tends to wax and wane. There are times when more people move from Minnesota to South Dakota, and then that reverses. Much of that, I believe, has to do with the local job growth conditions, particularly in southeastern South Dakota. I think we need to remember that the main population centers of North and South Dakota are actually very close to the Minnesota border. That virtually all the growth that's occurring in both of those states occurs very close to the Minnesota border, and that is the focus of the entire state. That is not to say that tax policy does not have an impact, but I would caution against making a very simplistic judgment, because people do tend to incorporate many aspects of their lives in the decision to move. The decision to sell a home and move across the river or something like that is a very large scale decision, and the differentials would have to be enormous to make that worthwhile. On the other hand, most longer distance migration tends to be focused on job related kinds of issues. That is overwhelmingly the single largest reason for migration is jobs. So in general, we see more of a migration flow into areas that are experiencing strong job growth, and that tends to be where people move into than tax differentials.
I have a couple questions. Well, first of all, we talk about broadband a lot in the rural areas, and we know that the kids are wanting to come back. Do you think that they will come back when that happens? I know some of them are already doing it already, and some of the people on the lake are doing that. Is that a reality that people will go, because if they have that kind of a broadband piece?
Madam Chair, I think we did ask that question back in the 90s. Of course, back then the internet was still, in its infancy, but there was a lot of interest and a lot of discussion about that at the time. In the late 90s, there was a considerable amount of discussion about the internet being the new railroad. That if you have the railroad coming through your town grows. If it doesn't come through your town doesn't grow. If the internet comes through you and you can connect to your house, you can do business with anybody anywhere in the world. If it doesn't, then, well, you're basically outlawed. I think that is still a potential that I'm not sure has been fully achieved yet. We did note in our turnaround analysis in the 90s, we did note that there were people that were moving to the lake, for example, and doing their job from there. That they had the kind of job that they didn't have to actually locate at the job. They could do their job anywhere they wanted, and for some people that lake location was the preferable place. Which would not occur if they don't have that internet connection. But we also heard from manufacturers who noted that they really can't afford to have a plant or an operation in the Twin Cities, but if they have an operation in St. Crookston, and internet connection where they can do the transactions and people can view their product and from the Twin Cities and then ship it to them, that they felt that they could compete. And I think that there has been some of that. I don't think that we've reached that full potential of.
Right. Another question that I have is, there might be new laws with immigration and that would be changed for our rural areas. Do you see that happening? Not necessarily if you know if the laws are going to be different, but I know in my community a lot of them are leaving because they're getting sent back to Mexico or wherever. So, will that be a factor if there are new laws in immigration?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that comes under the general area that economists would refer to as cost, that having stringent laws and stringently enforced tends to raise the cost. It does not necessarily prevent behavior. If the returns to that behavior are sufficient to override that cost, then people will engage in the behavior. There are, I've talked to many businesses that are concerned about the nature of and the vagaries of immigration law and the nature of our current system. And I know the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has been actively engaged with employers all around the state addressing this issue specifically. And certainly changing the law may have some impact. The impact would depend upon the degree to which and the nature of the change.
My last question is, when I started here, it was 50-50, metro, rural. We're now about 60-40. I want to know what it's going to be in 2010.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have a specific, but we're continuing to increase the increasingly metro society.
Thank you. There are two people that I want to recognize. My intern, Kevin, and our Paige is going to another position. So thanks for helping us, and good luck. So committee is adjourned.